Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into complex ideas and distill them into essential knowledge, giving you a shortcut to being truly well-informed. Today, we're not just opening a book, we're embarking on an extraordinary journey into a 17th century masterpiece that feels remarkably, almost eerily modern. We're talking about Robert Burton's The Anatomy of Melancholy. Now, you might hear a book from 1621 on melancholy and think, you know, it's just a dusty historical curiosity. But this deep dive will show you it's actually a profound shortcut to understanding human suffering, mental well-being, and even yourself in ways that resonate deeply right here, right now.
Our sources today are fascinating analyses of this monumental, sprawling work, guiding us through its vast, often surprising insights.
Indeed, what's truly fascinating here is that Burton didn't just, well, write a book. He created an entire cosmos of thought around what we now recognize as depression, anxiety, and a wide spectrum of existential angst.
Right, like the original Guide to the Mind in Distress.
Exactly. Think of it that way. Our mission today is really to unpack this encyclopedic investigation and extract its timeless wisdom, showing you exactly why its holistic approach and deep, unvarnished empathy remain incredibly relevant in our fast-paced, often isolating, modern world.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Who is the mind behind this immense, sprawling work?
Yeah, the author was Robert Burton. He was an English scholar, a cleric, and a writer, a true intellectual.
And he spent nearly his entire adult life steeped in the libraries of Oxford, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Imagine a life just surrounded by thousands of books where knowledge wasn't just acquired, but lived, breathed, deeply internalized. That profound immersion, it really shaped every page of the anatomy.
So what made him uniquely positioned to write this specific book?
Well, I think it's twofold and utterly compelling. First, he was a genuine polymath. I mean, a man of immense, almost insatiable learning.
Wow.
He devoured thousands of books, synthesizing centuries of human thought from classical antiquity right up to his own era. He draws upon an astonishing range of sources, I think over 1,200 by some counts.
1,200?
Yeah, it's staggering. It makes the book this grand repository of Western wisdom on the inner life, blending medicine, philosophy, theology, even poetry. And it wasn't just superficial, it was a deeply integrated understanding.
But there's more to it, isn't there? It wasn't just academic for him.
No, not at all. And this is perhaps more important. He was a lifelong sufferer of melancholy himself.
Oh, okay.
This wasn't just an intellectual exercise. He openly admits in his preface, he wrote the book, by being busy to avoid melancholy. He used the immense intellectual labor, the sheer act of wrestling with these ideas, as a form of therapy.
So that personal stake.
Yeah.
That must infuse the work with something special.
Oh, absolutely. Profound empathy and a deeply human voice. He writes not as a detached clinician observing from Ajurians, but as a fellow traveler, you know, offering a hand to those caught in similar struggles, basically saying, I understand.
And he used that pseudonym, Democritus Jr.
Yeah, channeling the ancient Greek philosopher Democritus, who was known for observing human follies with like a mix of wry humor and deep compassion.
So it was a deliberate choice.
Definitely. Signaling his approach. Exhaustive, scholarly, yet intimately self-aware, delivered with both a knowing smile and maybe a sympathetic sigh.
So his authority comes from both the scholarship and the self-knowledge.
Exactly. That combination of intellectual rigor and intimate experience, it's a blend that gives his work such a unique and enduring resonance, I think.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. The Anatomy of Melancholy isn't structured like a typical book, is it? It's less a linear argument and more...
What?
A vast, sprawling, intellectual cosmos.
That's a great way to put it. It is truly monumental in scope and ambition.
So for a work that covers so much ground, what would you say is its central thesis? If you can even pin one down from such a labyrinthine text.
Well, at its core, the idea is that melancholy is universal. It's an affliction touching every aspect of human life. Physical, psychological, social, and spiritual.
It was pretty radical for his time, wasn't it? Seeing it not just as a moral failing or...
demonic possession, yeah. His insight was that mental distress is a fundamental part of the human condition. It's not simple, but complex, pervasive, with this vast interconnected web of causes, symptoms, and potential cures. He basically argues that no one is truly immune.
So the big question he's tackling isn't just what is melancholy?
No, it's more like what is the entirety of melancholy? He dissects it from every conceivable angle, medical, philosophical, theological, astrological, social, trying to create this comprehensive map of the human soul in its darker moments.
And his answer isn't just one thing.
Not at all. It's multifaceted. Combining the medical knowledge of his era, humoral theory and all that, with philosophical wisdom, religious faith, and really practical everyday remedies, it's an attempt to capture the whole messy truth of human suffering.
It published first in 1621, but he kept revising it obsessively, right? Through five editions.
He did. And the result is this staggering hybrid of genres, a part medical textbook based on humoral theory.
Can you just quickly remind us what humoral theory was?
Sure. It was the dominant medical idea back then that four fluids, or humors, in the body, blood, yellow bile, black bile, phlegm, governed health. An imbalance, like too much black bile, was thought to cause melancholy, affecting mood, digestion, everything.
Got it. So part medical text.
Part philosophical treatise on human nature, part theological discourse on faith and despair, part literary anthology packed with quotes, and even part, surprisingly, a kind of self-help manual. It really defies easy categorization.
Much like the human experience it describes, I suppose.
Exactly.
Now, navigating this book,
yeah,
it's not straightforward. His style is famously digressive, isn't it?
Yeah.
He wanders off into tangents, anecdotes, quotes.
He does, but that's not a flaw. It's absolutely part of the design, a deliberate choice.
How so?
Well, the digressive associative structure isn't just, you know, a stylistic quirk. It deliberately mirrors the wandering, restless, sometimes obsessive nature of the melancholic mind itself.
Ah, interesting.
Burton takes you on this intellectual maze, and the very act of following him through this vast web of ideas becomes part of the therapy he advocates.
Keeping the mind occupied.
Precisely. Keeping it engaged with this expansive pursuit combats idleness and stops you dwelling on fixed, dark thoughts. It's active engagement.
And he kicks it off with that unique preface, Democritus Jr. to the Reader.
Yes, which is itself a remarkable piece of writing. Long, brilliant, deeply personal. It sets the empathetic, witty, and learned tone for everything that follows.
And that's where he says,
I write of melancholy by being busy to avoid melancholy. It's an open confession, a key to his method. And he famously declares the whole world is basically a madhouse, teeming with fools and madmen, and that melancholy is just part of being human.
So the preface isn't just an apology for the book's sprawl.
No, it's a profound declaration of its therapeutic purpose for him and for you, the reader, right from page one.
Okay, so then he structures it into three main partitions. Let's start with partition one, causes, symptoms, and kinds of melancholy, the diagnostic section, basically.
Right, and this raises the question, how wide did he cast his net for causes?
Pretty wide, I'm guessing.
Impossibly wide. He starts with a medical understanding, humoral theory, excess black bile, as we said, but then he brings in almost everything under the sun.
Like what?
Well, supernatural causes God's will, demons, astrology, reflecting that 17th century worldview where spiritual and physical were intertwined.
Okay, typical for the time.
Then natural and inward causes, heredity, age, temperament, constitution.
Right.
Then external and environmental causes. He focuses a lot on the six non-natural things.
The controllable factor.
Exactly. Diet, eating wrong or too much. Air, bad air. Exercise, too little or too much. Sleep patterns. And critically, perturbations of the mind, overwhelming emotions. He saw these as key levers on the body's humors.
And then the social and psychological causes. This is where it feels really modern, doesn't it?
Uncannily modern. He discusses poverty, solitude, excessive study, something he knew firsthand. Rivalry, grief from loss, shame, and powerful emotions like sorrow, fear, envy, jealousy. Mm-hmm. He really got how circumstances and our reactions shape our inner world.
And the symptoms. He's just as thorough there.
Oh, absolutely. Diving into both physical and mental signs, painting a comprehensive, often chilling picture.
Physically.
Things like dark complexion, thinness, chronic digestive issues, palpitations, headaches, a general wasting away.
And mentally.
This is where he's incredibly insightful. He describes fear and sorrow without any apparent occasion, pervasive suspicion, paranoia, misanthropy, restlessness, dark, obsessive thoughts, even vivid delusions.
Illusions, like what?
He recounts examples, people believing they're made of glass, they're already dead, or hearing demons whisper. His descriptions are eerily precise, often resonating with things we'd recognize today.
Wow. Okay, so after dissecting the disease, how does he propose to cure it? Partition two, the cure of melancholy.
Right. And what's fascinating is how many of these cures, despite being 400 years old, still resonate.
Really?
Yeah. He starts with general advice, changing your environment, maybe moving somewhere more pleasant, and crucially, focusing on those six non-natural things. A balanced diet, fresh air, regular exercise, consistent sleep.
Foundational stuff. Any modern therapist would agree?
Absolutely. Now, some of his cures are very 17th century: purging, emetics, bloodletting.
Okay, definitely outdated.
Right, outdated, even dangerous now. But they show the desperation back then to find tangible physical fixes for mental suffering, a quest that, continues today, just with different tools.
But the mental and spiritual cures,
Yeah.
that's where the real gold is, isn't it? The timeless wisdom.
Without a doubt, his most famous prescription is concise and powerful: be not solitary, be not idle.
Be not solitary, be not idle.
Yeah. He argues passionately that idleness is the devil's cushion, leaving the mind vulnerable to dark thoughts. Meaningful work, or busyness, as he calls it, anything purposeful, is the best defense.
And solitude.
He believed it amplifies dark thoughts, lets them fester. So he champions good company, real friendship, cheerful conversation as essential antidotes. He's basically talking about occupational therapy and social connections centuries ahead of their time.
Amazing. What else did he recommend?
Oh, a whole array. Reading especially history or pleasant stories, not just gloomy stuff. Listening to music, he called it a powerful charm. Travel. Hobbies like gardening, hunting, collecting.
Things to engage the whole person.
Exactly. And for spiritual solace, philosophy, prayer, scripture, trusting in God's providence, but urging a balanced faith, not extremism. It's a truly holistic toolkit.
And finally, partition three, dedicated to love melancholy and religious melancholy. These aren't minor points for him, are they?
No, they're huge, almost standalone books within the anatomy, which really highlights how deeply intertwined emotions, relationships, and beliefs were with mental well-being for Burton.
Tell us about love melancholy.
Okay, so love melancholy is this rich, often humorous, but also deeply insightful exploration of the, well, madness of romantic love.
Yours.
Yeah, he details the causes of beauty, flattery, unrequited desire, and the symptoms range from obsession, sleeplessness, despair, to writing terribly bad poetry. His cures, varied. Logical persuasion, intense distraction, travel, or even pragmatically, marriage. He really captures that all-consuming, often irrational nature of infatuation and heartbreak
Your religious melancholy.
that deals with spiritual despair, the fear of damnation, mainly. But he also critiques religious zealotry, extremism.
So for despair.
He advises focusing on God's mercy, charity, seeking wise, compassionate counsel. For zealotry, he advocates a balanced, reasonable faith, warning how unchecked enthusiasm or rigid doctrine can cause profound distress. These sections offer a window into the 17th century mind, but also echo modern existential crises, don't they?
They really do.
Yep.
So, okay, let's pull back. After diving into the structure and content, what are the core ideas, the big takeaways that still feel relevant that resonate with you today?
For me, the most fundamental and maybe most liberating is the universality of melancholy.
That idea that everyone experiences it in some form.
Exactly. It flips the script on shame. In his time, mental distress was often seen as a moral failing, weakness, even demonic. Burton basically said, look, you're not alone. This is part of being human. That's huge. It's destigmatizing centuries ahead of its time. It connects you to humanity, doesn't isolate you.
That refrain, all the world is mad. It's almost comforting in a strange way.
It is. Second, and just as vital, is the interconnectedness of mind, body, and spirit. Long before psychosomatic medicine or holistic health became buzzwords, Burton got it.
You can't separate them.
Right. Mental health isn't separate from physical state, environment, social life, spiritual well-being. A poor diet could sour the mind. A troubled soul could make the body sick. So his cures are inherently holistic. He understood you have to treat the whole human ecosystem.
Which makes total sense.
Yeah.
And his own experience clearly led to another theme.
Yes, knowledge and busyness as therapy. Writing the book cured him, and he prescribed that remedy to others. Keeping the mind occupied, study, work, hobbies, pursuing knowledge, it's his primary defense against idleness and obsession.
Like early bibliotherapy and occupational therapy.
Pretty much. The intellect wasn't just for scholarship, it was a tool for mental survival. Learning, creating, engaging provides structure, meaning, distraction from darkness.
And fourth.
The importance of balance and moderation. This is rooted in classical ideas. Melancholy itself is an imbalance, too much black bile or extreme emotion. So the cures aim to restore equilibrium.
Balanced diet, work rest, solitude company.
Exactly. Finding the right blend, maintaining reasonable faith. He constantly warns that excess in anything, study, eating, emotion leads to madness.
Okay, and finally.
His profound humanity, empathy, and understanding of shared suffering. Despite the scholarly depth, the anatomy is just so humane, so compassionate.
He uses all that learning to build bridges.
Yes, to show your deepest fears, anxieties, sorrows have been felt and articulated by countless others throughout history. And honestly, so much of it sounds like what a wise therapist might say today. He's a true precursor to modern psychology, showing that to help, you first have to understand and empathize.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more. Burton's writing, even though dense, it's full of these absolute gems, right? Lines that really stick. What are some quotes that capture his wisdom?
Yeah, there are some powerful ones that summarize his worldview. First, I write of melancholy by being busy to avoid melancholy. That's his raw motivation and a core recommendation, purposeful activity as an antidote.
Turning suffering into creation.
Precisely. Second, be not solitary, be not idle. Probably his most famous advice, the concise cure. Isolation lets dark thoughts fester. Idleness leaves you vulnerable. Solution. Activity and company.
Simple but profound.
Third, all the world is mad is melancholy dotes and who is not. That captures the universality theme. It normalizes the struggle, makes it a shared human story, not an isolated feeling.
Right.
Fourth, slightly darker, the whole world is an hospital of incurables.
Oof. Pessimistic.
Maybe, but also strangely comforting. If everyone's afflicted, no one's truly an outcast. There's a weird solidarity there.
Okay. And one more.
What is a man but a microcosm, a little world, a model of the universe?
Yeah.
Using that classical idea to say our internal states reflect broader cosmic and social conditions, your inner world mirrors the outer world, deep interconnectedness.
Wow. So bringing this all home, what does this mean for you listening today, living in the 21st century? How can insights from a 400-year-old book actually apply now?
Well, I think Burton's work offers really profound and practical insights. First, it urges us to adopt a holistic view of mental health.
Beyond just brain chemistry or a diagnosis.
Exactly. It's a powerful reminder that well-being is deeply connected to our social lives, physical health, environment, purpose, spiritual outlook. So pay attention to all those areas, friendships, diet, exercise, sleep, nature, meaning. If you're struggling, look at the whole picture, not just one fix.
Okay, that makes sense. What else?
Second, it's an invitation to embrace bibliotherapy and lifelong learning. Burton's life showed the healing power of intellectual curiosity.
So consciously engage the mind.
Yes. If you're dealing with intrusive thoughts, anxiety, purposelessness, engaging the mind can be so therapeutic. Learn a skill, dive into a hobby, visit a museum, explore a new topic. That conscious intellectual engagement provides structure, meaning, and a needed mental diversion.
And that emphasis on activity. It's very modern, isn't it?
Absolutely. The power of routine and activity, be not idle, is a cornerstone of modern therapies. Like CBT, behavioral activation is key.
Just getting started with small actions.
Right. Establishing a routine, engaging in hobbies, doing meaningful work, staying physically active, it can profoundly impact mood, combat lethargy. Starting small can create a powerful ripple effect. Timeless behavioral advice.
And fourth,
the critical importance of social connection. Be not solitary. In our age of digital isolation, screens mediating everything.
His advice to seek good company is more vital than ever.
Totally. Actively invest in relationships. Call a friend. Join a club. Engage in community. That face-to-face human connection is such a vital buffer against loneliness and despair.
And finally, maybe the most important.
Perhaps. It helps destigmatize and normalize mental struggle. By showing melancholy as universal, affecting everyone from scholars to kings for millennia, Burton strips away the shame.
Seeing your struggles mirrored in history.
Fosters self-compassion, understanding, and it makes you ask, right? Are we sometimes too quick today to look for a single cause, a simple pill, when Burton shows us suffering is almost always this rich, complex tapestry of physical, social, spiritual, psychological factors all interwoven?
That's a powerful thought. This deep dive into the anatomy of melancholy really does highlight the timeless complexity and profound universality of our inner world.
Yeah.
It teaches us there's no single cause, no simple cure for our deepest sorrows, but that hope and healing can be found in a balanced, engaged, and interconnected life.
I think the most valuable lesson, perhaps, is that psychological suffering, while intensely painful, isolating, is ultimately a shared human experience. It connects us. It doesn't have to divide us.
Right.
And Burton's comprehensive approach shows that real well-being requires this holistic attention, physical, social, spiritual, intellectual, not simplistic reductionist fixes.
So in a world full of quick fixes and maybe superficial self-help, what can we really learn from this 400-year-old, sprawling, unapologetically complex anatomy?
maybe about truly understanding, accepting, navigating the messy, melancholic, yet profoundly human experience, perhaps the depth of the exploration itself. Maybe that's the ultimate cure for our often superficial age.